Good afternoon. It's 63 degrees in Richland Center at 12:09. For WRCO News, I'm Joanne Krulatz. The results are in from Tuesday's Richland Center mayoral race. Karen Tepley defeated Elijah Kramer in a close race, 530 to 520 votes. There were also 23 write-in votes. Chris Jarvis in District 1, Frank Hoffman in District 2, Doug Martinick in District 3, and Ryan Cairns in District 4 were all unopposed and elected to the Richland Center City Council. In the race for Richland County Board District 14 seat, Darlene Waldsmith Tagliapetra defeated Michael Windle, 122 votes to 59. The city of Boscobel has a new mayor. Dirk Brown defeated Brenda Kalish with 68.5% of the votes, defeating her 532 to 245. At this point, in the Ithaca School Board race, with only one municipality not reporting the numbers, we have Steve Lewis with 304 votes, Marty Richards with 261, Mandy Brown with 242 votes, Gia Maestri with 230, and Justin Manning with 177 votes. The top three vote getters will serve on the board. In school district referendums, Weston School District residents said yes to exceeding the revenue limit by $1,500,000 for the next 3 years by a 54 to 46% vote. 400 residents voted yes and 343 voted no. Voters in the Reedsburg School District approved to exceed the revenue limit with 2,688 voting in favor and 1,969 voting no. The School District of Wisconsin Dells referendum to exceed the revenue limit failed, with 1,623 of the voters saying no, while 1,402 said yes. The Dodgeville School District referendum question to exceed the revenue limit narrowly failed, with 50.9% of the votes, 1,680 to 1,619. And Baraboo School District residents said no to issue general obligation bonds for paying the cost of a school facility improvement project, 3,195 no votes to 2,880 yes votes. The Wisconsin Supreme Court will add another liberal justice. By a 60% to 40% margin, Dane County Appeals Court Judge Chris Taylor defeated conservative Waukesha County Appellate Court Judge Maria Lazar in Tuesday's spring election.
Tonight, the people of Wisconsin stood up for our rights and freedoms, our democracy, our elections, and a strong state Supreme Court that will protect the independence of our beloved state.
Taylor will replace retiring conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley, expanding the liberal majority on the state's high court to a 5-2 count. Liberals are now guaranteed to hold a majority on the court until at least 2030. The Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system has unanimously voted to make a change in leadership of the system, with current President Jay Rothman's tenure ending immediately. The board stated it is grateful for President Rothman's service and recognizes the meaningful work undertaken during his tenure. Under his leadership, the universities of Wisconsin took steps to address longstanding structural deficits, putting individual universities on sounder financial footing for the future. He worked hard to bring the best to the campuses, students, faculty, and staff. Those efforts and that dedication are acknowledged and appreciated. However, despite these accomplishments, based on the annual performance review and subsequent discussions, the board has lost confidence in President Rothman's ability to lead the UWs moving forward. Universities of Wisconsin Vice President for University Relations, Chris Patton, will serve as acting executive in charge prior to appointment of interim president. The board has immediately moved forward in its work to identify the successor. The Board of Regents says UW's work will continue unabated during this transition. On Friday, the governor signed Assembly Bill 905, authored by Senator Howard Markline and Representative Tony Kurtz, into law. Act 197 fixes state law to define health and care facility and health care provider in a way that guarantees that all individuals providing critical health care are properly protected and able to do their jobs safely, regardless of where they provide care. Act 197 addresses an unintended problem in current state statute that was brought to lawmakers by Sauk County District Attorney Michael Albrecht. During a recent rape case, Albrecht found there was ambiguity about whether threats made outside traditional healthcare settings could be charged. As a result, while prosecutors could charge someone for threatening to cause bodily harm to a nurse in a hospital, they could not charge someone for making the same threat to an EMS provider working in an ambulance. Act 197 protects all healthcare professionals working in their official capacity, including EMS personnel, nurses, and other providers. The bill received bipartisan support in both houses of the legislature before being signed by the governor. Wisconsin's ability to meet the growing demand for high-quality educators depends on retaining more teachers and keeping newly trained graduates in the state, according to new data in a report released by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Using 2023 to 24 data, the report shows that while Wisconsin continues to prepare thousands of new teachers each year, too many are not entering or staying in the state's classrooms. Of the 5,256 individuals who completed educator preparation programs, just 3,568 entered Wisconsin schools, meaning the state lost 1,688 potential educators, or roughly 30%. The report also points to modest improvements in overall teacher retention, but keeping educators in the profession remains a significant challenge. By their eighth year, just 52.6% of teachers remain in Wisconsin public school classrooms. State Senator Sarah Kieski was on WRCO's morning show with Phil Nee yesterday and compared the changes in the teaching profession.
It was a legacy. It was a career that gave such purpose and stability to the school, to the pupils, to the community. And now it is a career that both pays quite poorly compared to what the standard of living needs to be these days. And it's a career that has been in some ways underappreciated and at times demonized in a way that is heartbreaking. So people that have gone into the profession wanting to serve and benefit kids and share their love of learning has turned out to be a painful journey for many of these people that then feel like they're pawns in this political nightmare that has happened, where they're, like I said, demonized and not paid enough. And so being in the career now feels more discouraging than purposeful, I think, for many. Thankfully, not all, and some are really trudging and continuing. But I think we need to make a big, profound effort to cherish our teachers, to honor them, to treat them like we do other people of great public service, like our military, like our police officers, like our firefighters. I mean, that's who they are too. And until we do that, I think we're going to continue to have people leave the profession.
Retention is even lower among special education teachers, with only 43.2% remaining by their eighth year. To address this issue, the DPI launched the Special Educator Induction Program in 2023, which supports first and second year special education teachers and aims to improve long-term retention. The program has supported about 750 early career educators, with 95% reporting they are likely to remain in their positions in the field. Compensation also continues to play a major role in educator retention. After adjusting for inflation, total compensation for mid-career educators, which are those entering their 15th year, is 22% lower than it was in 2010. Kieski feels investment in education is important.
I think we need to recognize, partially because we have a budget surplus. How better can we use that budget surplus than to invest in our schools in a way that helps then, right, prevent those property taxes from having to go up and protecting our citizens, but also making sure that we are investing in our young people, because that investment in their brains and in their potential is an investment in the growth of our economy and the betterment of our collective society as a state. So it's not a cost in my mind. It's a pure investment that trickles out in some significant ways for all people of our state. So I can't see a better way to use some of our budget surplus, which is $2.5 billion right now, than to do that kind of funding, which would be something we could do immediately.
For more information and to view the full DPI report on teacher retention, visit the DPI's website. As the weather warms up, Amplify Health by Gunderson is reminding children and adults alike of the safety precautions they should take as they dig out their outdoor recreational equipment, including electric bicycles and scooters. Kelly Hilsebeck is the Trauma Injury Prevention Coordinator with Gunderson.
E-bikes and e-scooters have become very popular over the last several years, and we've also seen injuries from them increase also nationally and locally. So as the weather gets nicer, there's the potential to see more injuries occurring from these devices. And e-bikes and e-scooters are potentially more dangerous because they just operate very quickly, and a lot of times people do take them for a ride that may have never rode one before and aren't familiar with how they operate, how they handle, even if you hit a small bump. So they're just, from a safety perspective, much more dangerous than your normal pedal bike or normal push scooter.
As many start riding an electric version of the two-wheeled transporters, there are actions riders can take to better protect themselves and their loved ones.
Because we know that a lot of these riders of e-bikes and e-scooters are not wearing helmets, and a lot of the injuries are occurring from, you know, losing control, the most important thing that riders can do is to make sure that they're wearing a helmet, you know, every ride, no matter what age they are, and really making sure they know how to operate the device before they get on and take a ride. You know, the other important thing is to make sure that you kind of adopt the assumption that others can't see you. So it's very important to stay visible and ride predictably. We don't want drivers of motor vehicles, we don't want to assume that they can just see us. These devices move quickly and they're quiet. So we really need to stay visible and ride predictably, which really just means follow the rules of the road. You know, slow down in busy areas, stop at stop signs, you know, use hand signals for turning. I feel like it's important to follow your local laws and ordinances related to e-bikes and e-scooters, because they really change from place to place on what's required when you are out riding these. And, you know, avoid distractions. We don't want you on your cell phone when you're riding these devices, and we don't want your headphones in. We just want you aware of your surroundings as best as possible. So I think, like, from a safety perspective, it's just really important to remember that wearing a helmet is going to be one of the most important things you can do to protect yourself from a severe injury. And just remembering to stay visible and ride predictably. These are great modes of transportation. They can be fun, and a lot of the injuries can be prevented.
With the warming temperatures, Amplify Health by Gunderson advises taking extra precautions when riding electric bikes and scooters. Why we serve Native Americans in the United States Armed Forces will be on display at the High Ground Welcome Center in Neillsville, April 10th through July 6th. Why we serve Native Americans in the United States Armed Forces was produced by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. It tells personal stories of Native Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Alaska Native veterans who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces, and brings recognition to those who have served their country selflessly and with honor for more than 250 years. Visitors will learn about the origins of Native American military service, how indigenous languages were used to win battles, the service of Native women during World War II, and the heroics of Native Americans from the Civil War, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, and through the conflicts in the Middle East. The exhibition asks, why would a culture serve a country that overran their homelands, suppressed their ways of life, and confined them to reservations? What is revealed is that Native people have served for many of the same reasons as others, to demonstrate patriotism, pursue employment, education, or adventure. Yet tribal warrior traditions, treaty commitments, and responsibility for defending native homelands have also inspired military service. Why We Serve is a comprehensive look at Native military involvement and explores Native American military service from its origins to the modern day. Through compelling freestanding displays and extra content, visitors will discover the little-known but outsized contributions Native Americans have made to the U.S. military throughout our country's history. The High Ground invites Native American veterans and tribal members to share veteran stories, tribal history, and memorabilia within this exhibit while it is on site. For more information, email Teresa at museum@thehighground.org or call 715-743-4224.